It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer.
1955, a year of anxiety and triumph. A major medical hurdle was crossed with the discovery by Dr. Jonas Salk of the anti-polio vaccine, which was to spread a mantle of protection over millions of American children. And the scientist entered the ranks of the medical immortals. Leading drug firms shifted into high gear to meet a national demand, which spread to every crossroads despite early controversy. Each hastily set up center became a mecca for anxious parents shepherding little Johnny and little Jill to their inoculations. They're protected, and it didn't hurt a bit.
That's a newsreel clip from 1955, which may have sounded a little over the top, but there is no way really to overstate the impact of the Salk polio vaccine developed at the University of Pittsburgh. Until the Salk vaccine was introduced, polio was considered the most frightening public health problem of the post-war United States. Of nearly 58,000 cases reported in 1952, over 3,000 people died, and over 21,000 were left with mild to disturbing paralysis, with most of the victims being children. 3 years later, a field trial was set up to test the Salk vaccine. Nearly 2 million school children took part. And when information about the vaccine's success was made public on April 12, 1955, Dr. Salk was hailed as a miracle worker. Tomorrow, October 28th, would have been Dr. Jonas Salk's 100th birthday. And to commemorate the event, the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health is hosting a special centenary symposium looking at the other side of Salk, who in his later writings focused on a concept now called sustainability. Among the speakers is Dr. Peter Salk, the son of Jonas Salk, who joins us now in Studio A. Peter Salk, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Tomorrow is a centenary that's being held to honor Jonas Salk. The symposium is called Sustainability, Survival of the Wisest. Explain the focus here.
Yeah. I think what's important is that my father always, during his entire life, was concerned with human interactions. After the polio vaccine, he wanted to set up a new institute, which initially was going to be here at the University of Pittsburgh, which would not only look at experimental medicine in what one would consider to be its usual context, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, but to be concerned with the problems that arise from man's relationship to man. He wrote 4 books in his later life, Man Unfolding. The second book was The Survival of the Wisest, which is a play on the phrase frequently associated with Darwin, the survival of the fittest. If we're going to make it and make it the way we'd like to be, the way we'd like to see the world be, we're going to have to develop more wisdom in our life.
You mentioned something interesting, that his institute was originally supposed to be at the University of Pittsburgh, and
correct,
it ended up being out in California.
Yes.
Why did that happen?
Well, he wanted a lot of independence, and the university at the time just wasn't structured for that.
So when we talk about the symposium tomorrow, who will be taking part? What are some of the important things that the public should know about that are going to be discussed on the Pitt campus tomorrow?
Yeah, there'll be a number of prominent speakers. One is Jeffrey Sachs from the Earth Institute at Columbia University, a major force in the field of sustainability and sustainable development. There'll be Van Jones, the host of CNN's Crossfire, Nicholas Kristof, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at the New York Times, and many others. It's going to be a really power-packed group of people.
And as you look at the relationship between sustainability and public health, what are the things that you'll be focusing on?
I just want to share my own personal perspective. When we think about public health or global health, what is there in our world today that doesn't influence our own health as individuals and our health as a society, whether it's the degradation of the environment, change in climate, the population growth, war? All of these issues affect us in terms of our own health. So we have to have this broad view when we consider what is taking place in the world today.
Does it seem extraordinary to you that we seem to have a certain number of distractions in our lives that permit us, for whatever reason, to kind of put these things out of our mind, even though there are all sorts of things happening that we can affect one way or another that are impacting our health, and yet we just seem to just skip over them.
Education is really important, as is just the way we live our own personal, individual lives. It's natural for us to be concerned with all the details of our life in the limited scope of what we experience every day, but to be able to expand our focus and become aware of the consequences of all of our actions, not only on us, our families, our nation, but on the extended environment and on the future. My father accepted an award in 1977 called the Jawaharlal Nehru Award for International Understanding. When he gave a speech at the time of accepting the award, the title was a question: are we being good ancestors? We need to keep this broad scope in mind with everything that we do, even though we're living our lives as individuals.
And what was the approach that your father took to addressing human needs? I mean, we know what he did, certainly in the field of medical research, and the polio vaccine speaks for itself. But he never let go of this idea that there were things that could be done. There was so much more research, so much more to be learned, and he seemed to have kept that as his philosophy throughout his life.
Absolutely, and that was the intention behind establishing what's now called the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, not only to investigate the fundamental biology, the cause, prevention, and cure of disease, but also as it was put in the Articles of Incorporation back in 1960, understanding the factors and circumstances conducive to the fulfillment of man's biological potential. So what he wanted to do was not only have the most prominent researchers at the Institute, but also to engage conversations among people in the biological sciences, people in the humanities, people in the social sciences, to confront those problems of humanity that can't be solved in the laboratory.
And when it came to improving the quality of human life and for improving the chances of survival on this planet, what were the things that Jonas Salk, your father, felt were critically important?
Changes in values and attitude, and he drew a very simple diagram. It was like an S-shaped curve where it starts out low, it begins to increase very rapidly, and then plateaus. The human population has been increasing exponentially over recent centuries. It can't continue at that rate. We live on a finite planet. It cannot contain an infinite number of people. But if you look at the shape of that curve, the first portion is upgoing. The second portion is flattening out. What he reasoned was that there are two different dynamics in those two different periods of human evolution. And what is important now is to make a shift in emphasis from focus on competition, on a self-centered attitude, on overcoming external constraints, on growth as the dominant force, to change those aspects of our thinking and our experience more towards cooperation, towards an attitude of mutualism, towards imposing self-restraints. He saw this as critical to have this kind of an inner shift in our own perception of ourselves and the world if we're going to make this transition successfully from one phase to another.
It sounds like he was very much, certainly was, ahead of his time when it comes to this idea that people are now sort of waking up to, that mankind tends to plan its technological developments and its evolution based on factors that do not include the number of and the limits of resources available, that our plans exceed what the resources might be. Did that play into his thinking?
You know, you mentioned a word that was central in my father's thinking, which is evolution. He looked at the entire scope of evolution in the universe, from the time before life appeared, a phase of pre-biological evolution, to what we normally think about as evolution, the evolution of new species and so on, to this current phase in which our own evolution is not changing the number of fingers we have and so on. It's an evolution in our thinking. And he referred to this phase as metabiological evolution. So that's where his focus was on what do we need to do now. One phrase that he used is that we are the products of the process of evolution, but we have become the process itself. What that means is that it's our thinking, it's our actions that determine the course of the future, not only for ourselves as a species, but for the entire planet. And we have to be very careful and very wise in the choices that we make as we move ahead and plan.
Was he optimistic about the future?
He was always optimistic.
He was always optimistic.
Yes, but not in a superficial way. He just had a deep sense of there being qualities within us that have evolved over time that we can draw upon in order to make the necessary choices and the necessary changes in our experience.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Peter Salk, MD, son of Dr. Jonas Salk and scientific director of the Jonas Salk Legacy Foundation. If you have a comment or question, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh, hashtag EPLive. And we'd love to have your input and your comments and questions again at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners are curious about what it was like to have Jonas Salk for a father. Well, what can you tell us about the type of upbringing that you had?
Well, it was very embarrassing as a child because I had a name that was so well recognized. It wasn't possible to just walk around and be anonymous. So that was a difficult period. What I began to perceive was that there were opportunities contained within that. There's so much that needs to be done to make the world a better place. And following on my father's life, to take advantage of his legacy, to help extend that and apply it now in this day and age, that's an opportunity that I wanted to take advantage of.
And it sounds as though there was a philosophy that was handed down in your family. As I understand it, your grandparents, your father's parents, did not have much in the way of formal education, but they wanted it very much for their children, and it sounds like their children wanted that very much for you.
That's absolutely right, and especially my father's mother was a very forceful person who pushed him as well as the other two sons in the family to succeed. My father initially thought that he would go into law to help change the laws that our society functions by, but very quickly got drawn into science in college, and that was the path that he followed from then on.
You worked with your father at his Institute for Biological Studies to find and develop an inactivated vaccine for prevention and treatment of HIV infection. Describe that collaboration.
First to say that I came to work with my father after my own medical training and spent 13 years in his laboratory until he closed that in 1984. He was interested in how to manipulate the immune system to our best advantage. For example, with diseases such as cancer, where there's something that's seemingly foreign, can the immune system be boosted so that it can help reject that foreign material, so-called foreign material, or with diseases such as diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, which are autoimmune diseases, the immune system's too active, so to speak, and you want to learn how to quiet it down. So that was the fundamental basis of his thinking when I was working with him. After that, he became drawn into the question of AIDS and began to think, well, a vaccine is needed. Perhaps we could just go back to the same simple type of situation that we did with the polio vaccine and use a killed virus to boost the immune system. Since after infection with HIV, there's a long period before symptoms develop as the immune system is being worn down by the virus, he thought we could boost the activity of the immune system to counter the effects of the virus during that period, even after people were infected. So that was the initial focus of that program.
And it sounds as though the feeling, the mood of the times was very similar. This would have been the 90s, very similar to what had been occurring 40 years before in the late 40s, early 50s with polio. People were deathly afraid of what might happen to their children. And in certainly the late 80s, early 90s with AIDS, I mean, there was all sorts of paranoia, how you get it, who gets it. And I'm imagining he was taking all that in and picking up on that sense of urgency and thinking, well, what can I do here?
I think that that's true. Early on with polio, it was the fear was such a predominant element, and that was one of the greatest effects of the vaccine, was removing that fear. With AIDS, it's one of the things that became clear was it was known how it was transmitted, and you can make choices in your life to protect yourself and prevent becoming infected. So there's more of a sense of control. But still, it's still a significant problem in the world, and anything that can be done finally to develop a preventive vaccine to help complement what the treatment programs that now do exist, that will be a very important step.
You mentioned something interesting, which was that he was looking at AIDS the same way as polio in terms of this idea of maybe the approach to a cure was to expose someone to the virus. Explain that part of his thinking. And was that a radical approach when he first was looking at trying to cure polio in the 50s?
What was radical in the 50s was the approach of using a killed virus for a vaccine, because the thinking for decades had been that in order to prevent diseases caused by viruses, you needed to use a live virus to produce immunity. So it took a long time for that new approach that he was taking. He'd done that work before with Tommy Francis on the first influenza vaccine. It still took a long time for that to be accepted. With respect to AIDS or any other disease of that sort, the basic principle is you use some aspect of the virus in this case, use that to stimulate the immune system, whether it's a purified material from the surface of the virus, the killed virus, the whole virus itself, some weakened form, which would probably not be so practical as far as AIDS is concerned. And that would stimulate the immune system. What you want to do is to develop an immune response. Could either be an antibody response, which is all that's needed in polio. With AIDS, it's a bit more complicated, and once you've been infected, the so-called cell-mediated immune response becomes an important feature. So it's a more complicated problem with AIDS, because the virus, with polio, you get infected, the virus does its damage, and then it's gone. With HIV, the virus enters the system, and then it takes its own genetic material and incorporates that into your genetic material. The RNA in the virus is turned into DNA, and the DNA gets integrated into your own DNA. So that's there, and you can't simply get rid of that. It's going to take a great deal of effort to find ways that you can completely rid the body of the infection once it's established.
While attending the New York University School of Medicine, Jonas Salk stood out from his peers, not just because of his academic prowess, but because he went into medical research instead of becoming a practicing physician. What led him to make this decision?
It was just his own point of view. He was actually very skilled as a practicing physician, but he just wanted to do something that was going to reach humanity in a very broad way. And as much as he loved being a physician on a one-to-one basis, and as important and valuable as that is in the world, his focus was broader. He wanted to make a difference that would have a very wide impact.
And so your father accepted an appointment to the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and in 1948 he starts the work that would lead to the polio vaccine. What led him to take on this challenge in the first place and then devote the next 7 years that it would take to find the cure?
A knock on the door.
A knock on the door.
Yes. He came here with the intention of continuing work on the influenza vaccine program, finding new ways to boost the immune system in that respect. And he then got a visit from the director of research of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, known as the March of Dimes, who asked, would you be willing to participate in a program to determine for sure the number of different types of poliovirus there are, because to produce a vaccine, you needed to include all different types. Now, that was a very boring program, not something that was greatly intellectually stimulating, but he saw this as an opportunity. First of all, it was essential information, but this was a chance to get into this field, and he had the intuition from the very beginning that it was going to be possible to create a vaccine. So he very quickly began to shift the focus as the number of types became known to having a vaccine and getting that out, along with his research colleagues. This was a team effort. Julie Youngner was part of that team, is still here at the University of Pittsburgh. All of the people that he worked with were extremely important contributors to that program.
The newsreel clip that we referred to, or that we heard earlier, referred to early controversy surrounding the vaccine. What was it?
Well, I'm not sure so much that – well, the controversy that was there from early on and that persisted basically had to do with the whole live versus killed idea. And Albert Sabin, a respected polio researcher, had the strong belief, as did most others, that a live vaccine was the way to go. So there were differences in personality. My father was very gentle, so to speak, about all of this. He just wanted to cleave to the path that he saw, irrespective of what other people thought.
It's been said that your father, Jonas Salk, could have simply patented this vaccine and made it available as part of a commercial venture and personally profited greatly. But he did not do that. Why do you suppose that was?
The main reason was it never crossed his mind. He was focused 100% on get a vaccine out, have this effective, have this available. Looking back, and I've now gone through some of the archive records at the March of Dimes, it turns out that it really would not have been possible under any circumstances to patent the approach to the vaccine that was using techniques that had already been described and developed. What was important was how you put this together in a way that actually is going to work, that's going to make the vaccine safe and effective. The March of Dimes did look into a patent because I think that they wanted to protect the manufacturer to make sure that no one would come in and just make this in a way that wasn't going to work. But when the patent attorneys that had been engaged were trying to get my father's attention because they needed to talk with him to figure out can we do this or not, he just had no interest. He didn't want to take the time. He was wanting to focus only on the vaccine itself. So what I think is really important in understanding my father was his state of mind and his orientation. This was just not on his radar screen.
Hmm. I want to, before we wrap this up, I want to get back to this other side of your father and his interest in sustainability. He died in 1995. What would he be urging us to do today? There's nearly two decades since his death. So with that in mind, what would he be, if he were sitting here with us, what would he say?
I think he would say to know yourself. That actually is not those aren't words that I heard him utter. But I think the essence is there that we have the capacity to turn, to direct the course of the future, to turn the tide from what's been taking place and all the problems we're facing towards how we're going to make this world the way we would like to see it. We have to look inside. We have to become in touch with the quieter parts of ourself, to expand our own awareness of ourselves and our society. It's crucial that we do this own what that we take into account our own nature as we continue to engage in activities to try and improve life for everyone.
And what would Dr. Salk say about some parents' resistance to having their children vaccinated, which seems to be a sort of a new thing in our modern world?
It is new because back in the 50s, medical science was looked upon as a savior, so to speak. There were diseases that were plaguing us. The advent of vaccines completely changed that. So the diseases that were rampant back when I was young are practically non-existent at this point. People have forgotten. And it's really understandable that parents would be concerned, what are we doing with our children? Is this all safe, etc.? I think it's really important to keep in mind that if we begin to drop back on our immunizing our kids, it's going to have an effect of reintroducing these diseases, and I don't think that that's something that we want to see. And I think my father would have felt that way very strongly himself.
And that you may have just answered it, but just in the last minute or so that we have left, what was he urging later in his life? You know, as his last days were approaching, he died at the age of 80. What were the things he was saying? Boy, we've got to get this done. We have to address this.
My father wanted to address everything, so to speak. he just plain didn't stop until the moment that he died. But I think, again, what I would go back to is that question that he asked about, are we being good ancestors? As he said, that it's important not only to be good citizens of the world today, but to be asking ourselves as that question about being good ancestors. We just have to have our attention not only on the present, but also on the future generations.
And that's certainly something that's going to be addressed on the Pitt campus tomorrow. My guest has been Peter Salk, MD, son of Dr. Jonas Salk and scientific director of the Jonas Salk Legacy Foundation. Tomorrow he is speaking as part of a commemoration of what would have been Dr. Jonas Salk's 100th birthday. It is hosted by the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health, and Dr. Peter Salk will be among the speakers. And it's been a pleasure visiting with you here in studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, business consultant Sasha King has advice on creating riveting resumes. And later in the program, an interview with Steelers defensive end Breck Kiesel, who talks about being on the defensive line in the NFL at the age of 36. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.